Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
Today's program was brought to you by the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board. Did you know that today Wisconsin produces more than 600 varieties, types, and styles of American, international style, and original cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country? For more information, visit eatwisconsincheese.com.
I don't know about here where you live, but in Ann Arbor, nobody gets up in the morning and says, if I don't get a $15 sandwich, I'm going to kill myself. We had to give them a reason, and that was we were going to create this wonderful experience for them, and then we were going to introduce them to some really wonderful foods with our belief that great food is for everyone. That's kind of how we opened.
HeritageRadioNetwork.org presents Evolutionaries, Zingerman's. Paul Saginaw is the Chief Spiritual Officer of Zingerman's Community of Businesses in Ann Arbor, Michigan, which he co-founded in 1982 with Michael Monahan and Ari Weinzweig. The Zingerman's Community of Businesses now has 18 partners, employs just under 600 people, and generates over $44 million in annual sales from 8 separate businesses. Paul Saginaw is a shooting star, a brilliant and impulsive decision maker that continues to find success in his every venture. His community-minded approach to business has made Zingerman's into a standard bearer for equality, partnership, and sustainability. Paul grew up in Detroit in the 1950s, and it was obvious, even as a child, that he would become a relentless worker.
I don't know if I was typical or atypical. I was curious, and I was mischievous, and I liked drugs, and I liked music, and I liked adventure. But, you know, one thing I always knew from early on was I liked working. And when I was, I think I was around 13 years old, I had been in Cub Scouts, and you get a subscription to Boys Life magazine. And in the back of the magazine, there was the ads for different things, and there was the ads for Little Indian mini bikes. It was a kit. $109.95, came with a Briggs & Stratton lawnmower engine. And I went to my dad and I said, would you buy this for me? And he said, are you crazy? I work hard for my money. If you want something like that, go out and earn some money. So I went out and I got a job that I worked after school on a landscaping crew. And I don't think I have ever been without a job since that day. My grandfather was a small businessman who did a number of different things, but finally landed on a business with a partner called Universal Bearing Company. And what they did was they bought used and surplus ball bearings and they reconditioned them and then sold them. And I worked for him during the summers. He was maybe the largest influence on my life in terms of the values that I have. He used to tell me that half of what you own belongs to those who need it. And if you're successful, make your friends successful and bring them along with you. And he was a fastidious dresser. And even on a day on Sunday when he wasn't going to work, he would put on his starched white shirt that had his initials monogrammed on the cuffs, and he would put on a tie. And on Friday nights, I would sleep at his house, you know, with my grandfather and my grandmother, and it was Shabbos, a Sabbath dinner. And then I would sleep at his house, and we would watch TV at night together. We'd watch Harrigan and Son and 77 Sunset Strip. And then the next morning, he would shave and get dressed, and then we would walk out, and we would go to the barber shop every Saturday. He'd get a trim, and he'd get a manicure. And then we would walk down to Cunningham's and have a hamburger and a Boston cooler, which is vanilla ice cream and Werner's ginger ale. And then his business partner would pick us up, and we would go to the racetrack. He taught me how to use a slide rule, back then, and he would have me go down the race sheet, and on every horse, he would have me divide its total life winnings by the number of races it had been in, and then rank them all, and that was how he would handicap horses and bet. And so he introduced me to this world of gambling, and it was this man's world, and it was, you know, cigars and whiskey and gambling, and that certainly influenced me and has stayed with me, and I continue to go to Las Vegas a couple times a year, every year.
In 1975, he left a graduate program in public health to assume a position at the Real Seafood Company. Though he never poured a drink in his life, he was hired as a bartender. He later became bar manager, kitchen manager, and started to learn a lot about fish. It was there that Paul met Mike Monahan and Ari Weinzweig, who he'd eventually go on to start Zingerman's with. He started his culinary business journey, opening a fish market with Mike.
I had a belief that fish was going to get big. And back then, there was very little competition in the fresh fish area. The supermarkets and the grocery stores only had frozen fish sections. They didn't have fresh fish. I was learning a lot about fish, and my friend who was working there had fished all his life and knew a tremendous amount about fish. And so they weren't doing well with this fish market, and it wasn't anything they were really interested in. It was a diversion for them, really a distraction. And so we approached them and asked them if we could buy it. And so we bought it. You know, our idea was we were going to bring in products that nobody had ever seen. There might have been one sushi restaurant in the entire state, but you know, we were going to bring in sushi quality tuna, and we were going to have smoked salmon and hand slice it. I mean, you had to go to New York in order to get that. And on the first Saturday, the customer comes up, Jesse Bernstein, and he asks for a quarter pound of lox. And I go back there, and I'm really nervous, and I'm you know, slowly cutting it, and I lay it out on the paper, and I present it to him, proudly present it out to him, and he looks at it, and he goes, "That's the worst quarter pound of lox I ever saw in my life. What'd you do, cut that with a chainsaw?" And I was like, "Oh my God, we never should have bought this market. We're going to be failures. This is horrible." I'm still friends with him today. So I was working at the Real Seafood Company, and then they opened a second restaurant down the block called Maud's. And after it had been open for a few months and a couple people left, and they bumped me up to go be the general manager at Maud's. And the day I started was Ari's first day, and he had just graduated from University of Michigan with a degree in Russian history with a focus on the Russian anarchists. So his first day and my first day, and I asked him to come and help me straighten out this office that I was now taking over. And we started talking, and we realized we had a lot of things in common, a lot in common interests. And he grew up in Chicago, and I grew up in Detroit. And back then, in our neighborhoods and all the neighborhoods around you, there was a delicatessen. You thought yours was the best, and you could get a really great corned beef sandwich on real Jewish rye bread. Well, here we were in Ann Arbor, and it was just a wasteland. You could not get anything that even approached a corned beef sandwich. So on the weekend, we'd drive into Detroit and get a loaf of rye bread and a pound of corned beef and be happy. And we thought that, you know, Ann Arbor could use a good corned beef sandwich. And also, we started to develop an interest in good foods and better foods. Neither of us grew up in what you would call a foodie family at all, other than you had your grandmothers that brought over the traditional Jewish cooking from Europe, mostly around a holiday, though. But during the rest of the time, you were eating Mrs. Paul's fish sticks and Kraft macaroni and cheese, tuna casserole with Durkee's French fried onion rings out of a can on top, and Kraft American singles. But we started being interested in olive oil and vinegars and mustards and cheeses.
Their landlord at the fish market, Arthur Carpenter, bought a building across the street that would later become the iconic Zingerman's Deli. It wasn't long before Paul saw the opportunity and took over the space with Ari.
He actually wanted to put a delicatessen in there. He called it the Marketplace hyphen a delicatessen. And it was terrible. And it was open about 6 or 7 months, and he was losing money like crazy, which you can do in the restaurant business. And so he closed it, and I had a very good relationship with him, and he knew that I had managed restaurants. And he came to me and asked if I would like to go partners with him and reopen it, which, you know, like, yeah, when monkeys fly out of my ass, I'll go partners with you. But I said, you know, I don't want to do that, but I'd like to lease the building from you with all the equipment in it. And he was happy to do that because it's closed and he's paying the mortgage on it. And that was on a Friday or Saturday. And on Sunday morning, I went to Ari's house and I woke him up and I said, I found the location for us to open this delicatessen we've been talking about. And so we sat down at his kitchen table, and on a Smith Corona electric typewriter, we typed out our vision, our business plan, and it was very simple. It was 3 or 4 pages, but we said we wanted to gather the finest food products from around the world and have it in this little specialty shop. We really wanted to stay away from the term gourmet because that to us implied some kind of elitism. And our thing was good food is for everyone. And then smash down in the middle of this specialty shop, we were going to have this busy, bustling sandwich shop. And we were going to serve these sandwiches that were overstuffed. They were so big it would take 2 hands to get it up to your mouth. And when you finally bit into it, the Russian dressing was going to roll down your forearms. And this was very, very clear in our heads. So we had a vision of this business, and we had a vision of the type of organization we wanted, an organization where decisions were not going to be made based on who had the most authority, but who had a viable solution, who had information and data relevant to the issue at hand. We really wanted to push decision-making down as far as we could, and we wanted to invite everybody we were working with to come in and help run the business. We also said that we wanted to be unique. To us, that just seemed like a lot more fun. And by definition, that meant there's only one of you. We had never seen an operation that was really good and then grew by replication and actually got better. I don't know if you've ever been to the original Starbucks at Pike Market in Seattle. For me, when I go in there, there's still a vibrancy and it's this energy and a sense of history. And then there's the Starbucks on the Ohio Turnpike. And I don't get that same feeling. And that's really what we didn't want. We also made a strategic decision that we were going to produce and deliver this food to people with a very, very high level of service. This was 1982, and nobody talked about customer service. It was the third floor at Hudson's where you would, if you were unhappy with your purchase, they'd send you up to and you could negotiate with them. If you went to a bookstore back in 1982 and you went to the business section and you wanted a book on customer service, you wouldn't find it probably, or you'd have to special order it and it would be an academic publication. If you go into a bookstore now, there's dozens of volumes on customer service. I think there's one that's really quite a bit better than the other ones. It's written by my partner, Ari Weinzweig. It's called Zingerman's Guide to Great Customer Service. Our attempt was we were going to bring in the finest products, and we were a very small space. And we knew that if you're trying to sell really high quality, you can't compete on price. And so service was going to differentiate us. We felt that people were willing to pay a premium for being understood and treated well. Anything that we sell, you can get at 24 places within a 3-mile radius and probably cheaper at all of them. But at Zingerman's, we're going to wow you and service the hell out of you and have you understand that we really believe you're the most important part of our day. I don't think it was always obvious which direction we were going to go in. We have a wonderful partnership. I feel that I am extremely fortunate and privileged and blessed. for whatever reason, we kind of found ourselves in the universe, each other in the universe. I think that a good partnership is like a good doubles team in tennis. You know, it's truly working with someone else, and different than other sports. In basketball, you run up and down the court, and everybody might touch the ball, but you're really not communicating with everyone, and certainly not in football. There's a coach that's dictating the plays, and you know your role. But when you play tennis, you have to be really honest with each other about your strengths and weaknesses, because you're going to set your strategy according to that. And I think that's how a good business partnership works also. So as we were working together and starting to learn each other's preferences and abilities and where we were really good and where we could use a lot of work, we started to differentiate along those lines and along what we liked. We would sit down and we would divide out the responsibilities and the departments, and we didn't always hit it right. And there were times where I might be struggling with one department, or Ari might be struggling, and we say, "Well, let's trade for a while and see if that'll make a difference." But we honestly, one year when we were doing annual planning, we each wrote out a vision of where we wanted to be many years down the road. And Ari, he wanted to formalize and document our training. He wanted to be teaching classes. He wanted to be writing. He wanted to continue to source products. I said that I wanted to grow the organization, and I wanted to help bring people along a path to partnership. I wanted to spend 50% of my time in the nonprofit sector. And so it actually came to be, in an exaggerated way, I would say that you could never have enough data to make Ari comfortable making a decision, and I don't need any. When we first opened, we had a belief that you earn your right to do business in a community, and I don't particularly buy into traditional conservative economic theory a la Milton Friedman that the business of business is business. I believe that you earn your right to conduct business in a community, and you do that by being a good corporate citizen, and that means that you choose a location responsibly, and you build responsibly, and you hire a staff responsibly, and you produce a product and deliver a service responsibly, and you generate a profit responsibly, and you share that with the people that help you generate it and the community from which you draw it. And so really giving back to the community was not something that we were looking forward to do once we were successful. It was something that we built into the business plan, just like rent and utilities and insurance. Giving back was in there. And if that wasn't something we were able to do, then it was a flawed business plan. Byline, the slogan for our vision of 2020 is changing the world with every transaction. And for us, that's meaning that anybody that comes in contact with our organization, whether as an employee, as a customer coming in the door, over the phone, over the internet, someone asking for a donation, someone that wants to sell us something, someone that wants to do an interview. We want it so that anybody that comes in contact with us is going to leave that interaction with the perception that we exist in order to be of service. And when we started, we had some goals, but they weren't that lofty. But you go along and you experience some success, and you get encouraged, and your customers motivate you and push you on, and so you start to have bigger goals. And we didn't start out and say we want to be a very monochromatic organization and not be diverse. We always thought, if you ask us, yeah, we want to have a really diverse organization. Well, what we discovered is that it that doesn't happen unless you take specific steps in order to do that. And so we wanted to have an organizational mandate. And so in that vision, it says that by 2020, the racial makeup of our partners group, not just entire staff, of the partners group, has to be at a minimum reflective of the demographics of the county that we do business in. An organization that is diverse makes better decisions. They have better strategy. They're more successful because the more you bring in other people's experience and worldview that you can't possibly have. And so that was what we wanted. We didn't think about the environment when we opened that much. Now we all think about it all the time. And so because we have a position in our industry that people look towards us, then we have a responsibility to really to be a leader in that. And it's a big ship we have, and it's hard to steer, but we're moving on it. And so we have a goal of by 2020 that we're going to have that we're going to be carbon neutral, and we're going to have zero waste. It's lofty, but we believe we're going to get there. I remember when I was in the emergency, I'm in the bed, and they got the tubes in me and nitroglycerin and whatever is going on, and the doctor comes in and says, Mr. Saginaw, you've suffered a heart attack. And I said, I don't think so. And he looked at me like I was the stupidest person in the world. He says, I'm not giving you my opinion. I'm telling you what actually happened. I think there's this club that I'm now part of. The club is people that have had this event in their life. It could be you walked away from a terrible accident, or you've had a heart attack and you survived. Whatever that event is, you do take stock and you reevaluate things, and you think about what's important. Certainly, when you first think about whether your life is not going to quite be as long as you thought it was, and you think about your mortality for the first time, I know that I started to think about, if my life is short, if I only got a year, or if I only got 6 months, what do I want to do? Am I doing anything? Would I do things differently? You take a very critical look at what you're doing, and I realized that I love what I was doing, and I wanted to continue to do it. And I'm fortunate that I'm in a position, if I don't like my job, if I don't like my work, I have no one to blame, because I have the ability to change it. So I'd be a big spoiled baby if I was complaining.
The Zingerman's 2020 vision calls for more businesses being added, even more emphasis on local sustainable food sources, and more people on board to help share in the American dream by being able to buy houses, raise families, and send their children to college. Along the way, Zingerman's intends to help customers and community alike. Zingerman's celebrated their 30th anniversary in 2012, and they continue to grow without compromise. This piece was produced by Aaron Fairbanks and Jack Inslee for HeritageRadioNetwork.org, with additional research by Sari Kamen. In order of appearance, the songs used in this program are The Hustle by Alan Wilkes, Krippy Fnook by Space Disease, Wet Cock by Ball of Flame Shoot Fire, Numb by Tackstar, Lonesome Now by Four Lincolns, Butterscotch by Tackstar, Knife Show's remix of Polyhedron by Little Jinder, and again, The Hustle by Alan Wilkes. Thanks for listening to this program. HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. For all of our programming and more, visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.